Jill Burke and I covered a lot of the trial, not all of it, but a great deal of it, and we had very interesting times after the trial or at breaks and other points discussing it, what was going on, what we'd seen, what we expected, evaluating the performances of various people involved, and that is why I asked Jill to come today, because I so enjoyed my conversations with her and her insights into the trial and the people who are participating in it. Let's start first of all with how this all began, at least in the legal the court system. In March of 2011, three men were arrested in an industrial yard in Fairbanks, not far from downtown Fairbanks. They were booked on a variety of weapons charges and conspiring to kill federal officials. In mid-May to mid-June of this year, they were tried here in Anchorage in the federal courthouse. I thought I might just lay out for you what you would see if you walked into the courtroom in here in Anchorage, and what we're going to, on any typical day, observe the trial. On the left, or in front of you, you would have the judge, Judge Robert Bryan, who had come up here from Tacoma. My understanding is he comes from a long Pacific Northwest family, has a University of Washington degree, and he's been, I think he's 80 years old, and he's been a judge for for quite a number of years, and was clearly a very experienced and seasoned judge for this trial. On the left, if you're coming into the room, would be defendant Lonnie Vernon and his defense team. In the, below them, so to speak, would be Tim Dooley, who is here, and his client Coleman Barney. Below them and further was Nelson Traverso and his client Schaefer Cox. And over on the right, you would see the jury. The prosecutor's team was in front of you, Steve Scrocchi and Yvonne Lamoureux, and there were others as well. Agent Sutherland, who has also joined us, was at the table frequently, if not all the time. And then there was, I sort of am reluctant to call it the audience because it makes it sound like it was a play. That isn't what we had here, but there were a number of people who came all the time. Some of them were reporters like myself, Jill, Richard Maurer, the Anchorage Daily News. And there were members of the Barney family. There were quite a number of them, including his parents, his wife, his in-laws, his brother at one point, quite a variety of members of the family. There were Schaefer Cox's father, Gary Cox, and his wife. Gary Cox is a Baptist minister in Fairbanks. He came quite often, but not all the time. And Schaefer Cox's wife, Marty Cox, came from time to time. It's also interesting, this was the first trial I had attended with multiple defendants, so it made this a very different trial. First of all, just physically, the logistics of it was very crowded in the courtroom. Also, I should add that the defendants on any given day would be brought in by a United States Marshal. They were handcuffed, the handcuffs would be removed, and they would be seated. There were marshals in the room at all times, the defendants were in the room. And they rotated around, but usually there'd be three marshals in front of the bar and a couple in the back of the room to provide the kind of security that would be necessary, presumably for the kind of charges that were brought against these defendants. That is the scene, as if you walked into the courtroom and we were there today, that you would see before you. Jill, I'm going to turn it over to you. Why don't you tell us about the three defendants? Who were these men?
Well, Schaefer Cox, who is the militia leader, who was kind of the ringleader of the group, is a younger guy. He's in his 20s. He was homeschooled. He moved here with his family from Colorado, I believe around 2000. Correct me if that's wrong.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Had entered college, didn't finish it, developed some political aspirations, ran for the state house legislature in 2008. That was a failed attempt for him to gain office. And then in 2009, we start to see him gain a little bit more visibility working the circuit of people who are really subscribing to kind of constitutional conservative belief systems, sovereign citizen belief systems. He's becoming increasingly more vocal, showing up at public events in other states, and at some point catching the attention of the FBI. He's married. He has a young child. He's developed a a host of groups in the Fairbanks area that relate either to gun rights, to the preservation of liberty, to developing a militia, and has become increasingly entrenched in some battles with the court system where he had disagreements about the way they were either handling a child custody case, a domestic violence case against him, and a minor's weapons case. The other two gentlemen, Coleman Barney and Lonnie Vernon. Coleman Barney is a married man who comes from North Pole. He's an electrical contractor, self-made businessman, very successful member of the Mormon Church, and had come to become associated with Cox, I believe, through this initial inquiry into how do we preserve our constitutional rights, how do we restore government to a more correct path. And then Lonnie Vernon is the oldest of the three. I believe he's in his 50s. He and his wife live in Salcha. He was an angry anti-government tax protester who had lost in federal court an IRS lien against his home, and the IRS was in the process of seizing his home. I don't recall, Michael, how he became acquainted with Schaefer Cox. You might. I don't.
No, I don't at the present time.
Right. So this is the three men who were members of the Alaska Peacemakers Militia. Cox is the leader. Barney had become a major in the militia, and Vernon had always remained relatively low rank, and I believe was a sergeant.
Okay. So how did these three men get into so much trouble? Well, I at one point asked one member of the Barney family this exact question. Coleman Barney's father-in-law, who was up here from Utah, he would be obviously the father of Rachel, Coleman's wife. He just looked up at me and said, they were framed. There are obviously other ways to look at this. And part of what happened here is these men responded to the spirit of the times. I think this is very important, that they became particularly active and particularly concerned after the 2008 election. The economic hardship and upheaval of that time, the decline in the economy, clearly had an effect on them as they worried about the possibility that the country might be becoming unstable. The people who sat through every minute of the trial, and there are a few of them here, will correct me if I get this one wrong, but my memory is I never heard Barack Obama mentioned by name in the courtroom. But clearly his spirit or his image or his presidency was in some way overarching in the view of this group, that either he was going to be presiding over bad times, or certainly that he was the kind of president, Democratic president, that would be interested in taking away firearms and limiting gun rights. There were places in the testimony and in the comments that I both saw on video and heard from the defendants when I couldn't prove that they were quoting Glenn Beck, Rush Limbaugh, or other conservative commentators, but it seemed to me that these were very close paraphrases of the concerns about what would happen to lawful gun owners in the new times that were coming, in the new times that were brought by President Obama. Tell us about the judge, Judge Robert Bryan, a little bit more.
Well, as you mentioned, he's a judge from the federal bench based out of Tacoma, Washington. He was a Reagan appointee, appointed in 1986. I don't know much about his personal history, but I know from the trial, he reminded me a lot, actually, of the judge that presided over the Ted Stevens case, Judge Emmett Sullivan in Washington, D.C., in that he was very knowledgeable. He liked to have kind of all the parties mind their P's and Q's. He wanted to be very straightforward. He was congenial with the jury, very kind to them, very thankful of their service, injected humor when he could to bring some levity to the proceedings, and he was interesting. And I know from the bail hearing that Coleman Barney had in Fairbanks prior to the proceedings being moved to Anchorage, I got the impression that he himself is either a gun owner or a gun enthusiast or someone who may even be a collector, which was interesting to hear him discuss as someone who was questioning the legitimacy of some of the proceedings that had been brought against Barney at that time and how much how much of a flight risk or a danger to the community Barney would be.
Yeah, and there were a couple occasions when the judge with the jury out of the room and there were Well, one of the occasions was, I think it was at the end of the trial when they were cataloging various exhibits, came down and talked to us in his shirt sleeves, and there were concerns that reporters had, and that was fairly amazing. I'd never seen that before.
He was, I would have to say, he for a member of the press, the press pool in general, he seemed much more accessible than other judges I have encountered. Judge Sullivan was to an extent. He wasn't perhaps as formal in his relationship with the press and allowed you to engage him and ask questions. And if he couldn't answer a question or it was inappropriate, he would just say, you know, I can't deal with you on this matter. But you could just flag him down if you needed to.
Okay, so Jill, why don't you tell us how the government made its case?
Well, I think they were.
And this is obviously going to be have to be making a long story short.
Right. Well, I think the issues that played out publicly were, was this just a group of men who were unfairly targeted for speech that the government found unpalatable and in some way dangerous because it would attack its power base, or were these really legitimately dangerous men? And I think in the end, the government was able to show, at least with the murder conspiracies, that they were dangerous. And then there was also a weapons case, and the weapons case seemed fairly straightforward. Either you had the illegal weapons or you didn't. Cox had a machine gun. There wasn't a way to get around that. He admitted that in court. Either you had the destructive devices the way they're defined under the ATF regulations or you didn't. And these men admitted that they had the flare launchers coupled with the anti-personnel rounds, which by ATF definition is a destructive device. And I don't know that you had to make a case much beyond that in order to be successful.
Here, the weapons cases seem to me very binary. Either you were breaking the law or you're not. And this was really a seminar for those of us who are not experts in the law on gun ownership and weapons ownership, of what you can own and what you can't own and the circumstances you can own them in. And you can own silencers if you purchase them properly and if you register them and you pay some money and you wait a number of months. So that the circumstances, in fact, you can own pineapples for the hand grenades. You can't have them with powder and fuses and making them into weapons. But I've had friends who have had pineapples in their home as sort of collector's items or paperweights or curiosities or whatever. So this was very interesting to those of us who were not in the know about the seminar aspect of this of weapons law and the whole question of silencers and powder. And then there were all these expert witnesses who came on and talked to us about the nature of powder and testing powder and about the nature of silencers and how silencers work. Until this trial, I did not know how a silencer worked. I never knew one, and there's all this inside argot that people who are in the know call silencers suppressors, and how they suppress the sound by reducing the escape of heat. And people will put, hair gel in the muzzle of their pistol or rifle,
and further reduce
the heat. And these guys take these things to Washington, or maybe it's the various labs back east, and they test these silencers to find out, you know, just how they work and do they work and the whole question of their legality. So there was a lot of this. And there's one thing I wanted to mention here, and that is the lawyers in this case on both sides were very different than when Jill and I and others covered the corruption trials, because in those cases, especially the federal attorneys wouldn't talk to you at all. They just treated us like we didn't exist, and maybe that's what we deserved, but that's what we got. And here, the attorneys on both sides were very good, not about tipping their hand or you know, giving us inside dope or talking about, you know, reviewing necessarily what was going on in the courtroom, but telling us who the witnesses are we're going to be next, what we might expect in the way of testimony that afternoon, not characterizing necessarily, but so-and-so represents the ATF, he'll be here for possibly so many minutes. This is very helpful to reporters. Because, among other things, we have to figure out people who are filing every day have to file every day. They need some time. And quite frankly, there were people who had dental appointments or they needed to take their child to some activity, and they wanted to know, listen, is there any chance I could sneak out of here for about an hour and a half? So that was very helpful to us.
Can I interject for a moment? So getting back to how the case was made, I think that there's the weapons case, which just seems fairly straightforward, and then there's this secondary issue of, so they had weapons, were they then going to be dangerous with those weapons, or were they a danger to the community, or were they going to do something harmful to judges and law enforcement and other individuals? And how do we know that that point had really been reached? How do we really know that these were men who needed to be stopped? And I think that that still may give some observers, some casual observers, you know, a little bit of trepidation. But I believe from watching the case and seeing the outcomes that in the end, the jury clearly believed that they did cross that point, that this wasn't a free speech issue, that they had taken steps, that in their private moments they believed that they were justified in taking the lives of other individuals to prevent apprehension or arrest. And that's clearly crossed a line for people.
Let's talk about some of the witnesses. Jill, there were surprises among them. Schaefer Cox's mother-in-law, Janice Stewart, testified. Tell us about her.
We did. Well, and she testified on a day where we had three
women. For the government, I should say.
For the government, witnesses for the government, where we had three women, all mothers, who testified. The mother-in-law was compelling because she made it clear that there was no love lost between her and her son-in-law, Schaefer Cox. From the beginning, they didn't like each other. They had had Marty Cox, Schaefer's wife, and Schaefer had had a short engagement. The mom had felt that he had begun to estrange Marty from the family, that he had displayed increasing desires for possessiveness and kind of sequestering her daughter from the rest of the family. And she worried for the happiness and the welfare of her daughter. And then over time, particularly after the election had been lost by Cox, she saw it increase, and she saw the kind of extremist language increase and the anti-government language increase. And there had been some suggestion that the mother-in-law may have been someone who had meddled in the private lives of Marty and her husband, and that she may have turned them over to OCS authorities to, you know, have the welfare of the children looked in on. And on the stand, she said, no, that's not true. But on that same day, we heard from two other women.
Before we go on to them, I would just add that Janice Stewart was incredibly poised given the circumstances that she was facing. I mean, she was there testifying for the government about her family, about very personal matters, and her son-in-law could go to jail for a very, very long time.
Right, and she mentioned that she hadn't gone forward to authorities, that she hadn't taken additional steps to intervene in some way because she wanted to keep the peace in the family. She wanted to make sure that her daughter knew if and when a time came where she needed a refuge or a safe place to go, that coming home to mom would be the place to do it. And I think that was believable. She came on a day where we heard from two other women. One was a longtime family friend who was also a member of the TSA, who would host these university gatherings for
Trina
students.
Trina Beauchamp was her name.
Trina Beauchamp, and kind of believed in this pay it forward mentality, where she would, you know, she really believed if she was kind and offered homemade food and some, you know, social engagements for these young people that forward in their life, they would do the same thing. She'd been the recipient of it early in her life. Cox had become affiliated with that group. I don't believe through his university affiliation, but more through the family's church affiliation
and
dad and mom. And he had shown up. And she described how on occasion, recently, one time he showed up at one of these lunches wearing body armor, which she thought was really strange. And then on a second occasion, he came to her and wanted to know if he was on the no-fly list. And she had told him, I can't tell you that, and the way you find out is you go to the airport and find out if they'll let you on the airplane. She hadn't known until the day before her testimony that her name appeared on this list that the government had characterized as the hit list that this group had been compiling of the people who were gonna be targets of their plan. And she was deeply betrayed by this and deeply rattled by this. And in the space of hours between the time she learned this information and she testified in court, she'd gone out and purchased a handgun. And in court, she broke down in tears. And it moved Cox, actually. Cox himself broke down at that point and, you know, screamed out from his seat, I think something like, Tina, I love you, I would never hurt you. I don't know that that's verbatim, yeah, but something to that effect. And she was clearly quite devastated by this. And then the third woman,
can I just,
yes,
finish up here on Trina Beauchamp. At the end, after she was talking about this list, she saw the name, seeing her own name on this list of yellow paper. That she was asked, "How did this make her? How did this make you feel?" And there was this pause, and she said, "Betrayed." And it was an incredible moment to be in a courtroom and hear this very, lovely, respectable, middle-class woman say that. I mean, you don't convict Schaefer Cox on that, but it's a moment where you, it's just very personally powerful. And it was also an exhibit of an exhibition of what happened in this trial and happens in many trials, as lawyers are quite familiar, where the ordinary suddenly becomes transformed into something extraordinary. Trina Beauchamp provided lunch and food and hospitality to these college kids from the University of Alaska. I assume they were Baptist. They might have been from here or someplace else, but they might have been from any church or just any group. We'll go over to this nice house. This nice lady will make us lunch and we'll visit. And then, so she does that. She welcomes Schaefer Cox, and then he starts showing up in body armor. And you're sort of, what?
Well, and I think they set an emotional tone in the courtroom that this wasn't just some intellectual inquiry that this group was engaged in. This wasn't just philosophizing in the extreme to make a point or try to come to some new realization or some new personal paradigm. But these were real people who had become caught up in some way, even tangentially with Cox and his group. And they were deeply fearful, and they were reasonable people. They were people probably like most of the other people in the courtroom. The third woman that day.
Yeah, Sarah Thompson.
Sarah Thompson was Coleman Barney's sister-in-law. She had taken refuge in the Barney home after separating from or divorcing Barney's brother. That had been contentious. The family stood by the sister-in-law, and she reported, Coleman Barney, when she first got to know him, was an apple pie kind of patriot, someone who really loved his country, really loved the Constitution, loved family, loved community, and was dedicated to all of it. Good provider, nice family man. But in the last couple of years, the last year, he had become increasingly infatuated with Schaefer Cox for reasons she didn't quite understand, and increasingly willing to put what she believed was himself at risk in service to Cox, being part of the security details. And it really went over the top for her when one day she's at home with her own two children. The Barneys themselves at the time had four young children. She sees Coleman Barney and two other men running across the lawn with serious weaponry. And it frightened her because she was very concerned that this could be another Waco, another Ruby Ridge. There had been comments to that effect. The group had declared themselves to be sovereign citizens who were not U.S. citizens, who were not going to be a part of this government. And she really was terrified that this was going to now be.
She made that clear.
This was now going to be the home base for this showdown that had been building. So she made swift arrangements, got her kids out of Dodge. 4 hours later that day, I believe, is when the raids occurred. And pretty soon the FBI is showing up at the Barney home.
Tell us about Trooper Wall and the relationship between Cox and Trooper Wall.
This is another bizarre episode in the world of, I guess, Fairbanksians and and Cox and the troopers. But another, sign of the small community. They were family friends. They were neighborhoods. They were neighbors anyway.
At one point.
He had moved away. Cox had made a couple of visits professionally to Wall in his office, talking either about the Second Amendment task force or gun rights. What would be the right word for it? That paper that they signed. They had
Second Amendment task force petition.
Right, some petition that, people said, we have a right to stand up to the government if there's any more infringement on our gun rights, and furthermore, if we're ever on a jury and a gun violation is brought to court, we would acquit, et cetera, et cetera. And so he had gone to have kind of professional conversations in the office with Lieutenant Wall. But at some point, Cox, in body armor, shows up at Lieutenant Wall's home, his private house, an address that Cox should not have had access to.
With his wife, yes.
And Wall related, feeling fairly unnerved by this, but went ahead and invited Cox in to have a conversation. Cox, at this point, had grown increasingly paranoid that there was possibly an FBI hit team out to get him, that he was on the run, that he needed to keep himself and his family safe. And they proceed to have this long conversation. And Wall described kind of what has come to be known as classic Cox ranting. I shouldn't say ranting. conversation where he would say, I don't want bloodshed. I don't want violence to come. You know it. I know it. I'm a man of peace, but I can't control my guys. You need to help me out here. Kind of reaching out, like with this, you know, as a diplomatic ally to another individual of who was a he perceived as a family friend and also someone with some influence in the community. Wall took it as a veiled threat, or maybe not, so, you know, not so much of a veiled threat, and clearly took some action to report that on up the chain.
Well, and this was sort of a very good example of, to me, Cox's psychology or lack of it. You go to the trooper's house, he's the deputy detachment head in Fairbanks, you put on this act, what do you think he's going to do? What do you think he's going to do? He's going to call somebody. This is one of the things Cox apparently in his egotism did not understand. He was constantly calling himself to the attention of people in the community in an unfavorable way. Now, I know there are people who, I mean, one of the things that always amazes me about going into the federal court building is the number of people who walk in there with their hat on backwards, baseball hats on backwards. And you know what I've observed after going to the court this long? Virtually every single one of those people is going to see their probation officer. Now, why would you do that? The answer is, because this is who I am, I don't care what you think. That's what the answer is to me. And there was a great deal of that with Cox and his incredibly inflated ego, which we can talk about in some other ways in politics. But finally, tell us about Bill Fulton before we move on here, and then I'll talk a little bit about Gerald Olson.
So Bill Fulton was one of the two paid government informants that were used to help make the case. Fulton was a military supply store owner here in Anchorage called Drop Zone. He was also someone who had become acquainted with the militia and who the militia had tapped to help supply to them grenades, and the silencers, other types of weapons that they might want. He recorded phone conversations and made a couple of trips to and from Fairbanks, and then was also a part of this militia convention at the Millennium Hotel here in Anchorage 2 or 3 months prior to the arrests, where some of these conversations took place in hotel rooms. He's someone that Cox and other defendants had said was really one of the instigators, that he was kind of an agent saboteur who came in with big ideas and violent ideas and pushed them, and actually Cox claimed was threatening that if they didn't get on board, they themselves would be the targets of some, you know, kind of violence or harm.
And we don't know what happened to Mr. Fulton, right?
No, I was driving by Drop Zone the other day, and I know that he left town, signed over his business to a former coworker or employee of his. That business was open for a little while under another name, but that building is now completely vacant. He showed up to testify, and I think that they did what they could to try to impeach him, but he withstood on the stand.
And a little bit about Gerald Olson.
Gerald Olson is the second government informant. He's the one who actually infiltrated the militia as a member of the militia. He's someone who had been known as, in the newsroom, we'd called him Mr. Septic, I think, or Mr. Sewer, because he had had a long history of scams and frauds against people. And in Palmer had gotten into trouble for building septic systems that were actually just holes with old cars piled into them. And, you know, has a long line.
Which led Mr. Dooley to, in one of his waggish moments, to ask, and how did you keep the sewage in? By rolling up the windows?
Right, yeah. So, you know, he has this long history of scamming people, and it didn't end. He got, you know, in legal trouble then, and it didn't stop. And, you know, he's got uncompensated, you know, victims, not only from those criminal cases, but a long line of civil cases, and had gone on then to, what was a septic scam in the early 2000s then became like log cabin building scams and other types of home building schemes where things went awry or services were never provided, and he shows up as one of the star witnesses.
I realize that the trials are very serious matters and that a lot's at stake, and for the men who were involved in this, their freedom was at stake, and also their reputation and their future. But for aficionados of trials, like reporters who cover them in these federal trials, there's a moment we inevitably look forward to, and that's the recitation and confession of the informant's sins. the prosecutors will try, and on this occasion did, to in effect immunize the informant, the confidential informant, by going through his various history of criminal activity, or some of it. And that happened on this occasion. And then Tim Dooley, representing Coleman Barney, wanted to ask Mr. Olson about these civil cases, and he was able to get that into evidence or get an opportunity to ask those questions after some wrangling and objection, and he did ask them. Mr. Dooley was sitting there, and he just was sort of matter-of-factly, it would go like this, and it went on for, what, 20, 25 minutes, half an hour, something like that. Mr. Olson, yes. Do you know a Helen Williams? Yes. How do you know Helen Williams? I was going to build a cabin for her. By the way, this is a paraphrase. I didn't memorize this stuff. I was going to build a cabin for her. And she gave you some money in advance? Yes, she did. How much did she give you? $3,000. And did you build that cabin? No, I never did. Did you ever give the $3,000 back? No, I never did. You do know that there's a civil judgment against you for this money, do you? Yes, I know that. Are you planning to honor? Have you honored that judgment? No, I haven't. So, do you know I'm Mr. Michael Carey? Yes, I know Michael Carey. I was going to build a cabin for him. So this went on and on and on. It has a sort of low key kind of. I wondered what the jury made of this because of the effect of it being repeated again and again and again.
Well, and Olson had a pending case, or a recent felony case,
right,
in which his service to state troopers in this case and others was used to mitigate his sentencing, and they brought that up. I mean,
right,
he had every reason, the defense claimed, to be someone who came to the table with great evidence against this group, because the better the evidence, the better his service, and the better his lot in this prior case, where it was he stole like a construction trailer or something, and never returned it after renting it. And again, it was very similar shades of all the scams that he's done for the last two decades now.
Yeah, and there was also a pretty interesting moment when Mr. Kirtner asked witness Olson, you haven't gotten paid for this. What do you think you ought to get paid? And of course, he had received some living expenses and some moving expenses since he moved in and entered the witness protection program. So Olson sat up there and sort of thought about it for a minute and said something like, I think I'd start high, about $300,000. So I'm sitting there thinking, wow. And he was asked, are you going to pay any of these judgments? And Olson turned and looked at the jury and said some version of, I've made mistakes in my life. The mistakes I'd like to rectify, and I'd like to get straight sort of with the universe, whatever, some version of that. And I thought, Mr. Olson was much more convincing as a crooked contractor testifying as a confidential informant than he was as a repentant crooked contractor. He was terrible. One of the things that I've wondered about is just how offensive a confidential informant would have to be to get the jury to simply not believe him. And my suspicion of that is that it possibly could happen in cases of like the classic jail room or jailhouse snitch where really it's somebody's word. In this case, there were tapes. There were lots and lots and lots of tapes. So whatever you felt of Olson, whatever you thought about Olson, there were always these tapes, and that was really important. There's a law scholar at University at Loyola Los Angeles, Alexandra Natapoff, who has become something of an expert on confidential informants. She's written a new book. It's called Snitch, which I think is an informative, unfortunate title because it has way too much attitude, but it will help sell books. There's no question about that. And she raises three questions that are really important to the confidential informant. First, are they lying? And that, of course, is something that gets sorted out in court, and there have been experts in this can cite you the number of cases in which it's been demonstrated that they have lied. why are we rewarding or tolerating people who have done wrong? I think the ultimate example of this is Sammy the Bull Gravano, who turned state's evidence on John Gotti, and he had a list of crimes 6 to 8 miles long, I think, by the time that he found truth, justice, and the American way in ratting on John Gotti. And then there's the question of suspension of the rules. What can the government, whether it's the FBI or the state or local marshal, whatever it is, require of an informant? And the answer is quite a lot. There's an example from the Seventh Circuit of a confidential informant who was required to commit an act of prostitution on a subject that the government was interested in. This was part of the terms of being a confidential informant and getting the kind of relationship that this woman had from the government. You would wonder about this, since it's also committing a crime. I also wondered if this person was wearing a wire. That would make for some interesting tape. But this is what Judge Posner had to say in this question of how far you can you go with a confidential informant. Confidential informants often agree to engage in risky undercover work in exchange for leniency, and we cannot think of any reason, especially any reason rooted in constitutional text or doctrine, for creating a categorical prohibition against the informant incurring costs such as the usual risk of being beaten up or, for that matter, bumped off. I love that from an appeals court judge, bumped off, by drug dealers with whom one is negotiating a purchase or sale of drugs, etc. So, anyway, let's move on, Jill. Let's talk about some of the major incidents. KJNP 241, Michael Anderson on the list.
Right, KJNP is this small television station out of North Pole.
Yeah.
North Pole, where Cox had an appearance scheduled in November of 2010, and he had brought with him a judge who was a member of the Assembly Post from out of state, which is his kind of alternative, Cox's alternative court system, which was going to refute the legitimacy of the Alaska court system, ultimately would hold a trial and jury for Cox at Denny's in February and acquit him of the charges that the state had already found against him. And it was Cox, it was this judge, it was Marty Cox, and another member of the militia. And they were all just kind of talking about the situation at hand. Cox repeated what he had said publicly in other venues about his belief that there was an FBI hit squad out to kill and silence him, that they were trying to utilize his child as a pawn in that, and a bunk Office of Children's Services inquiry to try to motivate him into violent action to protect himself and his family and ultimately execute him. And so he talked about all of this, and he also talked about how he would resist this and how he had the militia set up and ready to go, and that, you know, these times, these possibly violent conflicts might be coming.
Right. And briefly, 241.
And let me get back to KJMP. So KJMP was significant to the case because this is where Cox believed that he needed a security detail. Coleman Barney was head of security. They show up at KJMP and they enact a perimeter where they're actually manning the perimeter, heavily armed with the launcher, the flare launcher, and the anti-personnel devices. Their heavy weaponry, big floodlights, they're stopping people who are trying to come in to KJNP. I believe one person lived there after
several
hours. Yeah, and all in, you know, to protect Cox and this group from the prospect of either this hit squad coming after them or someone trying to arrest them. And this is the site where the possession of the destructive device, the launcher, was established, as well as some of the murder conspiracy, because the prosecutors argued that when the security detail left their houses, when they showed up there, they knew that they had committed to shoot to kill if necessary. And who were they shooting to kill? They were shooting to kill law enforcement officers or anyone else who might try to stop or apprehend them or who would draw down on them. The two-for-one plot, or the two-for-one scheme, was something that came up later in later months as they're talking about what are they going to do? How is the militia going to resist or send a message if Cox does get apprehended if some harm comes to the family. And it was suggested that 2-for-1, which is modeled after the Israeli defense.
Allegedly.
Yeah, allegedly. The Israeli defense of, you know, eye for an eye. So you take one, you take Schaefer Cox, you go after two members of law enforcement. You go after the state trooper, you go after the FBI agent, you go after the troopers. There was some discussion internally that we heard in recordings with the militia suggested by Olson, our upstanding citizen, that maybe it should be 5-for-1. He got scolded afterwards to not be, you know, not instigate and agitate in that way. But ultimately, they settled on 2-for-1.
Okay. I'm going to talk just very briefly about how the defense made its case. And these, believe me, this is totally broad brush. But for Nelson Traverso defending Cox, this was in large measure a free speech and entrapment case, that Cox had a right to be fearful. He had a right that, I mean, as many points, it was many times it was pointed out that many of the firearms and other items that, of defense nature that these men owned were legal to own. And so that came up many times. Mr. Dooley presented Mr. and he did have Barney testify on the stand, as Cox did testify, was a man of character. Olson is a liar, and one of the things Mr. Dooley did, that, and this is interesting because when you get these multiple defendants, one of a specific witness may be talking about one of the defendants and not anybody else who's there, because they may not. For example, when Janice Stewart testified, Mr. Dooley had his client Coleman Barney stand up, and he asked Ms. Stewart, have you ever seen this man? No, I never seen him before. Are you sure? Yes. This happened 4, 5, 6 times, and this was interesting because it's part of the feature of this multiple defendant kind of organization.
Well, I think it's also, you know,
over the trial,
throwing your lead guy under the bus.
Yeah, well, you could look at it that way too. I don't know. But I don't know him.
A lot of it was, you know, with Schaefer Cox. Yeah, those were Schaefer Cox's ideas. Those weren't Coleman Barney's ideas. Yes, that was Schaefer Cox.
Jill, you were there
Lonnie
when Cox
Vernon
takes the stand?
Yes.
Okay, why don't you talk about that for a couple minutes, and then we're going to wrap up with some of the ideological things. So go right ahead. Tell us about Cox on the stand.
You know, I think Cox was, it's hard for me to characterize Cox. I have tried to figure out what drives him and what is the makeup of his psychology and his personality. He likes attention. He's charismatic. He likes to be in control. He likes his version of events to be the version of events that ultimately people will perceive and see as reality. On the stand, he, I think, tried to answer questions, but also quibbled quite a bit over semantics and words. And what do you mean? Well, what did I tell you? Well,
Ms.
I can't Lammer quite answer that.
Ms. Lammer did a great job of reining him in and requiring him to answer questions and not philosophize. That's what he wanted to do. He called it philosophizing, telling the whole truth.
Right, and or you're not allowing me to get the truth out. And, you know, he's just tough to pin down. He was up there for a long, long time. He obviously wanted to say more. His own attorney had to get very curt with him at times to keep him right.
Well, Nelson Traverso said, answer the question.
Yeah, yelling at his client to answer what he needs him to on the stand. And Schaefer's just wanting to go on these long exposés.
Can I add something here?
Yes.
About Cox, you know, the great writer, journalist Richard Rovere wrote a biography of Joseph McCarthy, and at some point in this biography he said the truth wasn't in him. And that's the way it really was with Cox, and my impression was, you know, there are people, some of us do this, I mean, people do this all the time, including myself. You just love your story so much you make it a better story, but you don't make it a complete fabrication. And that's a lot of what he did is, I mean, for example, he claimed to have gone out to a trapping cabin in December and stayed for 6 months and told this story that on the face of it was, given my background, you know, totally implausible and probably largely made up. I didn't go check it out, but there was so much of this.
You get the sense that Schaefer Cox believes he can talk his way into or out of anything, and that came through on the stand. he is going to say or do whatever he needs to make his point or get somebody to believe him. And we saw that in the recordings. We saw saw that on the stand.
Marty Cox, we met with the press at one point at the end of the trial. His wife said sometimes he thinks he hears the spirit whispering in his ear. And I thought, well, maybe that explains a lot of it. There are also some churches that have a long tradition of the boy preacher who has been seized by the spirit. You don't need to go to divinity school. And there certainly was an element of that in him, of being seized by the spirit. And one of the things that fascinated me about this trial that I never got answered is what was the hold that Schaefer Cox, what of this charisma he had over Coleman Barney, who was a very different kind of person, much more down to earth and much more rooted. And there was one exchange that I learned about later after the trial that Cox had said, or rather Barney, who is Mormon, and there's a purpose in bringing this up, had said of Cox, "After all, you are the reincarnation of the angel Moroni." Moroni, as I understand it, is the angel who gave the golden tablets to Joseph Smith, which raised a whole bunch of other questions. Jill, let's talk real quickly here because we're going to run out of time about the alternative institutions, the Denny's Common Law Court, the Assembly Post, the Liberty Bell, and Alaska's Grand Jury du Jour.
Well, these are kind of the replacement government institutions that Cox was using either to delegitimize the Alaska court system and law enforcement's authority over him, the judicial system's authority over him. And I think, to network and create a social structure and kind of create people who would rally with him and, rise up against the so-called bully in the schoolyard. So we have the Alaska Assembly Post is a version of the National Assembly Post, which is the structure of courts, as mm-hmm. I understand it, that are an alternative court system, the true court system in which people can get fair and just trials. And Cox was holding his at Denny's with judges who would call in from out of state. Sometimes they would make personal appearances. The grand jury du jour is an extension of that. That's the grand jury that was convened at the Denny's to hold this trial.
This was one of the parts of the trial that, again, this is a very serious matter, but when a witness sort of says, are you talking about the real trial or the Denny's trial? I mean,
right, and he's serving,
And of course, the whole thing with Denny's, Cox later tried to make light of it, and I thought the prosecution did a very good job of, showing him for what he was, because he tried to say, oh, we were just fooling around trying to rattle the government's chain. After this trial found the issued this judgment against the government. So I think it was just, I had it originally as just the city of Fairbanks, but it may have also been the state. It was $32 million they were asking for,
right,
which I thought at the very least they could leave Denny's a pretty good tip. And, I made it, this of course led to all kinds of jokes, which I know are frustrating to people who are in the case. The trial at Denny's? What are you talking about? Your Honor, there's mustard on my hot dog. I object. Overruled. Eat it.
And I think, also what came up was the notion that you could issue your own arrest warrants for judges or law enforcement officers who were inappropriately coming after you.
Yeah, and this is one of the things that's really important. What Schaefer Cox made clear and the prosecutors made very clear in their both during the course of the trial, and I thought really did a good job in the summary, was this is a guy whose whole message to civil society was the rules don't apply to me. Nobody can make me do anything. I'm the person who sets all the rules and establishes all the rules. I just wanted to say a couple words about the ideological makeup of this group, and then I'm going to turn it over to Jill, and we got to wrap it up so that you can all get back to your hard work. It seemed to me they had read, at least Cox and Barney had, and they could quote major public figures, like historical figures, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Mandela. Cox quoted all of them on the witness stand. Cox astonished me by quoting John Locke and then referring to him as a French philosopher. There was also a variety of times when for example, in one of these speeches, he talked about Woodrow Wilson and the income tax, and that seemed to me to have been lifted straight out of Glenn Beck. So there was a kind of hodgepodge here. And then at one point, Marty Cox, when we met with her, explained that, you know, the militia groups in other parts of the country have been known as notoriously anti-Semitic. Not these guys. Cox had a copy, was in a Torah discussion group, and drove around with a copy of the Torah in his car. It was there apparently when he was arrested. When Cox was arrested the second time, which was for she showed up at an arrest when the police were there as part of this network of his, and there was a bus going down, and he showed up with a firearm and didn't tell the police officer that. The police officer, in the course of booking him, noticed he was wearing body armor and asked him, "Why are you wearing body armor?" And this was the Mel Brooks moment of the trial. "I'm Jewish." That was his answer. Okay. Jill, there was no psychiatric exam, but to use a word that we might hear quite frequently in common society, were these guys crazy?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that if they were, someone would have brought that that defense forward. I've wondered why that defense wasn't brought up with Schaefer Cox, and I believe it's two reasons. Probably the evidence wasn't there to support that claim, and secondly, Cox never would have tolerated it. It would have played into his conspiracy theory that labeling him as crazy is just another way to silence a dangerous dissenter, and I don't think that he would have signed off on that to any degree. But I have some other things to add if
Go
we
ahead.
Have time.
We
I
do.
Don't know if we have time. So getting back to the sign of the times. Or, you know,
the spirit
of the times in 2010. You know, we haven't, on the rise, the FBI, in terms of extremism and radicalism, watching different groups of people. Among those are included militia extremists and sovereign citizen extremists. Cox's group falls into both categories. The militia with the amassing of weapons and illegal weapons and the paramilitary structure, the sovereign citizens with the rejection of government structure, U.S. citizenship, engaging sometimes in white-collar crimes. I don't know that Cox did that, but he certainly did what would be considered paper terrorism, which is flooding the courts with these kinds of nonsensical, long, rambling court orders and other types of documents to tie things up and get things confused. And in 2010, that summer, is when a sovereign citizen extremist and his son, Jerry Kane, got into a shootout with police during a traffic stop, killed two cops, and then this dad and his kid end up getting shot at the same time. So nationally, I think the sensitivity to this kind of behavior, this kind of talk, this kind of suggestion that you can rise up against the government, that you have the manpower to do it, that you have the weaponry to achieve it, is going to get attention. Cox had to, on some level, know this. So I'm not suggesting that he was targeted because of a national movement. Certainly, this situation is, you know, local to Fairbanks, but the national tone and temper is of larger concern. And then regarding Cox, I, to this day, don't know why so many people who were respected, thoughtful, well-educated, upstanding members of the community gave him an ongoing time of day. You know, these men from Fairbanks, these spiritual leaders that he consulted and advised in and considered mentors. And I think that there are two things with Cox. One, well, a couple of things, is like the public celebrity that he enjoyed as a failed political candidate, then seeking out some kind of ego-boosting activity that would fill that gap. These other disenfranchised, yeah, unhappy people who were either unhappy about the spiritual direction of the country, the economy of the country, the safety of their family and children, you know, long-term stability. This is a fight for survival, and he knew how to kind of whip that up and foment that. But then privately, this growing paranoia that people are out to get him, and at some point, those become intertwined, and we have Schaefer Cox, the man who's convinced upstanding men like Coleman Barney to join his ranks, or has tapped the, you know, kind of more fringe-oriented, angry man like Lonnie Vernon to all work in service to him and to do things that are increasingly more unreasonable and to suspend that gut instinct that maybe I shouldn't go to the television station with my automatic weapon and my flak jackets and my body armor and run a security detail. Maybe I shouldn't be running those security details at courthouses. And I think that he was very skilled at tapping into those gut feelings that people have that something is wrong. Something is wrong with the country.
Yeah,
something is wrong with the economy. And using his intellectual capacities to kind of bamboozle people into staying in and sustaining that sense that something's wrong, and if I just stick with Schaefer Cox, somehow it will be better. I do know Barney at one point had said he didn't really believe Cox, that he was doing these things kind of out of sympathy for Cox. He felt sad for him, you know, felt like he would be disloyal if he didn't stand up to what Cox was asking for, but never really believed that these situations would end up in some kind of violent confrontation, that he was just indulging Cox until Cox finally fled the state and went away.
And there's, I just want to add one thing, and then we do have to break up, and that is that trials produce verdicts. Some cases they produce hung juries that don't provide a verdict, and there's a new trial. But trials frequently leave you with a mystery if you're somebody who goes there on a regular basis, or at least if you're a journalist like myself. And the mystery to me in this was, or one of the mysteries was, Cox had been, was fleeing from a domestic violence case that had been reduced to reckless endangerment, and this weapons case, which was a misdemeanor. These things could have been resolved. I mean, I think everybody who's involved was involved in this trial, and there are a number of them in this room, tell you, this did not have to play out in the way it did. And of course, life is contingent. There could have been other paths. We know that. But Cox, I don't know if it was his ego, his vanity, his incredible self-inflation, exactly what it was. He could not go down to that courthouse and accept his medicine from these authorities, and it probably would have been pretty tepid medicine. But he would not do that. So out of his refusal to, if you want to look at it this way, take responsibility for what he did or just own up or go to the courthouse, whatever it was, a whole lot of other things grew, and now we are where we are today. Jill, do you have a final word, or should we bid these nice folks goodbye?
I think we can bid goodbye or questions if there are questions.
We'd be glad to stay here and take questions or comments or observations for anybody who wants to stay, but I know most of you got to get back to work. Thank you for coming.